Recently, Cosmopolitan magazine, for some inexplicable reason, selected me as one of the, quote, most eligible swinging bachelors in Hollywood, unquote. They came and took my picture lounging on the steps of my bed with three attractive young ladies I had been dating draped around me. While it did my ego enormous good, I realized all the while that it was a shuck. I am, by no means, Baby Pignatelli, or Porfirio Rubirosa, or even Oil Can Harry. I am a poor Jewish kid from Painesville, Ohio, and New York City, who works exceedingly hard to keep up the house payments and buy himself enough time writing TV so he can take off 7 months a year to write books. I am by no means jet set. Actually, I understood why they selected me. All the other swinging candidates were from the same set, loafers and scions of wealthy families who had nothing to do but chase broads. They needed one common day laborer. Since I had been around that set but was not in or of that set, they felt I was just too perfect. Sort of a concession to all the grease monkeys and farm laborers in the audience, showing you too can make it in hotcha society if you keep your thumbs out of the anchovy dish. Being officially a swinging bachelor has its responsibilities. One has to make profound and penetrating comments on love and male-female relationships, among other duties. For my definitive thesis on the subject, see my forthcoming hardcover, Love Ain't Nothing But Sex Misspelled, from Trident Press. In case you weren't paying attention, that was the commercial, friends. Some years ago, during my first marriage, the lady with whom I was sharing a padded cell made the comment that all my stories were about violence and unhappiness and a world running amok. She challenged me to write a nice, simple love story, a boy-girl story that would warm the heart, kind of a Francis Parkinson Keyes story. I snorted with laughter. Deprecatingly, I replied that nothing could be easier for a diversified genius of my magnitude, so I sat down and wrote this tender, touching love story about a shell-shocked Marine and a blind girl in a madhouse, and I called it The Time of the Eye. In the third year of my death, I met Peretta. Purely by chance, for she occupied a room on the second floor while I was given free walk of the first floor and the sunny gardens. And it seemed so strange, that first and most important time, that we met at all. For she had been there since she had gone blind in 1958, while I was one of the old men with young faces who had dissolved after being in the NAM. The place wasn't too unpleasant. Of course, despite the high, flat stone walls and the patronizing air of Mrs. Gandhi, for I knew one day my fog would pass, and I would feel the need to speak to someone again, and then I could leave the place. But that was in the future. I neither looked forward to that day nor sought refuge in my stable life at the place. I was in a limbo life between caring and exertion. I was sick. I'd been told that, and no matter what I knew, I was dead. So what sense was there in caring? But Peretta was something else. Her delicate little face was porcelain, with eyes the flat blue of shallow waters, and hands that were quick to do nothing important. I met her, as I say, by chance. She had grown restless during what she called the time of the eye, and had managed to give her Miss Hazlett the slip. I was walking with head bowed and hands locked behind my bathrobe through the lower corridor when she came down the great winding stairway. On many an occasion, I had stopped at that stairway, watching the drab-faced women who scrubbed down each level, each riser. It was like watching them go to hell. They started at the top and washed their way down. Their hair was always white, always lank, always like old hay. They scrubbed with methodical ferocity, for this was the last occupation left to them before the grave, and they clung to it with soap and suds, and I had watched them go down to hell, step by step. But this time, there were no drudges on their knees. I heard her, walking close to the wall, her humble fingertips brushing the wainscoting as she descended, and I realized immediately that she was blind. That blindness, deeper than lack of sight. There was something to her, something ephemeral that struck instantly to the dead heart in me. I watched her come down with stately slowness, as though she tripped to silent music, until I was drawn to her in spirit. "May I be of service?" I heard myself politely inquiring from a distance. She paused there, and her head came up with field mouse awareness. "No, thank you," she said most congenially. "I am quite able to care for myself, thank you. Something that person," she twitched her head in the direction of upstairs, "cannot seem to fathom." She came the remainder of the steps to the napless wine-colored rug. She stood there and exhaled deeply, as though she had just put a satisfactory fini to an immense project. "My name is," I began, but she cut me off with a sharp snort. "And name's the same," she giggled prettily. "Names ring of little consequence, don't you agree?" And there was such conviction in her voice, I could hardly disagree. So I said, "I suppose that's so." She snickered softly and patted her auburn hair, bed disarrayed. "Indeed," she said with finality. "That is so, very much so." This was most peculiar to me, for several reasons. First, she was talking with a rather complicated incoherence that seemed perfectly rational at the time. And second, she was the first person I had spoken to since I had been admitted to the place 2 years and 3 months before. I felt an affinity for this girl, and hastened to strengthen our flimsy tie. "And yet," I ventured, "one must have something by which to know another person." I became more bold and went on. "Besides," gulping, "if one likes someone." She considered this for a long second, one hand still on the wall and the other at her white throat. "If you insist," she replied after deliberation, and added, "you may call me Peretta." "Is that your name?" I asked. "No," she answered. So I knew we were to be friends. "Then you can call me Sidney Carton." I released a secret desire of long sublimation. "That is a fine name, should any name be considered fine," she admitted, and I nodded. Then, realizing she could not hear a nod, I added a monosyllable to indicate her pleasure was also mine. "Would you care to see the gardens?" I asked chivalrously. "That would be most kind of you," she said, adding with a touch of irony, "as you see, I'm quite blind." Since it was a game we were playing, I said, "Oh, truly, I really hadn't noticed." Then she took my arm and we went down the corridor toward the garden French doors. I heard someone coming down the staircase, and she stiffened on my arm. "Miss Hazlett," she gasped. "Oh, please." I knew what she was trying to say. Her attendant. I knew then that she was not allowed downstairs, that she was now being sought by her nurse. But I couldn't allow her to be returned to her room after I had just found her. "Trust me," I whispered, leading her into a side corridor. I found the mop closet and gently ushered her before me into its cool, dark recess. I closed the door softly and stood there, very close to her. I could hear her breathing, and it was shallow, quick. It made me remember those hours before dawn in Vietnam, even when we were full asleep, when we sensed what was coming with fear and trepidation. She was frightened. I held her close, without meaning to do so, and her arm went around my waist. We were very near, and for the first time in over 2 years, I felt emotions stirring in me. How foolish of me to consider love. But I waited there with her, adrift in a sargasso of conflicting feelings, while her Miss Hazlett paced outside. Finally, after what seemed a time too short, we heard those same precise steps mounting the stairs. Annoyed, prissy, flustered. "She's gone. Now we can see the gardens," I said, and wanted to bite my tongue. She could see nothing, but I did not rectify my error. Let her think I took her infirmity casually. It was far better that way. I opened the door cautiously and peered out. No one but old Bauer, shuffling along down the hall, his back to us. I led her out, and as though nothing had happened, she took my arm once more. "How sweet of you," she said, and squeezed my bicep. We walked back to the French doors and went outside. The air was musky with the scent of fall, and the crackling of leaves underfoot seemed a proper thing. It was not too chilly, and yet she clung to me with a soft desperation, more need than inclination. I didn't think it was because of her blindness. I was certain she could walk through the garden without any help if she so desired. We moved down the walk, winding out of sight of the place in a few seconds, shielded and screened by the high, neatly pruned hedges. Oddly enough, for that time of day, no attendants were slithering through the chinaberry and hedges. No other guests were taking their blank-eyed pleasure on the turf or on the bypaths. I glanced sidewise at her profile and was pleased by her chiseled features. Her chin was a bit too sharp and thrust forward, but it was offset by high cheekbones and long eyelashes that gave her a rather Asiatic expression. Her lips were full and her nose was a classic yet short sweep. I had the strangest feeling I had seen her somewhere before, though that was patently impossible. Yet the feeling persisted. I remembered another girl, but that had been before the Nam, before the sound of a metallic shriek down the night sky and someone standing beside my bed at Walter Reed. That had been in another life, before I had died and been sent to this place. "Is the sky dark?" she asked. I guided her to a bench hidden within a box of hedges. "Not very," I replied. "There are a few clouds in the north, but they don't look like rain clouds. I think it'll be a nice day." "It doesn't matter," she said resignedly. "The weather doesn't really matter. Do you know how long it's been since I've seen sunlight through the trees?" Then she sighed and laid her head back against the bench. "No, the weather doesn't really matter. Not at this time, anyhow." I didn't know what that meant, but I didn't care either. There was a new life surging through me. I was surprised to hear it beating in my ears. I was surprised to find myself thinking minutes into the future. No one who has not experienced it can understand what it is to be dead, no longer to think of the future, and then to find something worthwhile and begin to live all over again. I don't mean just hope. Nothing that simple and uncomplicated. I mean to be dead and then to be alive. It had come to be like that in just a few minutes since I had met Peretta. I had ignored the very next instant for the past 2 years and 3 months, and now suddenly I was looking to the future. Not much at first, for it had become an atrophied ability in me, but I was expecting from minute to minute, caring. And I could feel my life ranging back to pick me up, to continue its journey. I was looking ahead, and wasn't that the first step to regaining my lost life? "Why are you here?" she inquired, placing a cool, slim-fingered hand on my bare arm. I placed my hand over it, and she started, so I withdrew it self-consciously. Then she searched about, found it, and put it over hers again. "I was in the war," I explained. "There was a mortar, and I was hit, and they sent me here. I didn't want to. Maybe I wasn't able to. I don't know. I didn't want to talk to anyone for a long time. But I'm all right now," I finished, abruptly at peace with myself. "Yes," she said, as though that decided it. Then she went on speaking in the strangest tone of voice. "Do you sense the time of the eye, too, or are you one of them?" She asked it with ruthlessness in her voice. I didn't know what to answer.
"Who do you mean by them?"
She bit her full upper lip and said, "Those women who bedpan me, those foul, crepuscular antiseptics." "If you mean the nurses in attendance," I caught her line of thought, "no, I'm not one of them. I'm as annoyed by them as you seem to be.
Didn't I hide you? Would you find me a stick? She asked. I looked around and, seeing none, broke a branch from the box hedge. This? I handed it to her. Thank you, she said. She began stripping it, plucking the leaves and twigs from it. I watched her dexterous hands flitting and thought, how terrible for such a lovely and clever girl to be thrown in here with these sick people, these madmen. You probably wonder what I'm doing here, don't you? She asked, peeling the thin green bark from the stick. I didn't answer because I didn't want to know. I had found something, someone, and my life had begun again. There was no reason to poison the moment. No, I hadn't thought about it. Well, I'm here because they know I'm aware of them. It struck a note of familiarity. There had been a fellow named Herbman who had lived on the first floor during my second year at the place. He had always talked about the great clique of men secretly trying to kill him, and how it would go to any extreme to get him, to silence him before he could reveal their dire machinations. I hoped the same thing had not befallen her. She was so lovely. They? Yes, of course. You said you weren't one of them. Are you lying to me? Are you making fun of me, trying to confuse me? Her hand sought mine again. I hastened to regain ground. No, no, of course not. But don't you see, I don't understand. I just don't know. I've been here so long. I tried not to sound pathetic. Somehow this seemed to strike her logically. You must forgive me. I sometimes forget everyone is not aware of the time of the eye as I am. She was pulling at the end of the stick, drawing off the bark, making a sharp little point there. The time of the eye? I asked. She had said it several times. I don't understand. Peretta turned to me, her dead blue eyes seeing directly over my right shoulder, and she put her legs close together. The stick was laid carelessly by her side, as though it had been a toy, but now the time for toys was gone. I'll tell you, she said. She sat very still for an instant, and I waited. Then, have you ever seen a woman with vermilion hair? I was startled. I had expected a story from her, some deep insight into her past that would enable me to love her the more, and in its place she asked a nonsense question. Why, no, I can't say that I think, she commanded me. So I thought, and oddly enough, a woman with vermilion hair did come to mind. Several years before I had been drafted, the rage in all the women's fashion magazines had been a woman named... My God, was it? Why, yes, now that I looked closely and my memory prodded, it was. Peretta, a fashion model of exquisite features, lustrous blue eyes, and an affected vermilion-tint hairdo. She had been so famous, her glamour had lapped over from the fashion magazines, had become one of those household names everyone bandies about. I remember you, I said, startled beyond words of more meaning. No, she snapped, no. You don't remember me. You remember a woman named Peretta, a beautiful woman who attacked life as if it was her last lover. And loved it fiercely. That was someone else. I'm a poor blind thing. You don't know me, do you? No, I agreed. I don't. I'm sorry. For a moment, she went on as though I had never spoken. The woman named Peretta was known to everyone. No fashionable salon gathering was fashionable without her. No cocktail party was meaningful with her absent, but she was not a shrinking violet type of woman. She loved experience. She was a nihilist and more. She would do anything. She climbed K2 with the Postroff group. She sailed with two men around the Cape of Good Hope in an outrigger. She studied the cult of Kali in India, and though she had come to them an infidel, at the end the Society of Thugs took her as one of their acolytes. That kind of life can jade a person. She grew bored with it, with the charities, with the modeling, with the brief fling at films, and with the men, the wealthy men, the talented men, the pretty men who were attracted to her and who were, at the same time, held at bay by her beauty. She sought new experience and eventually found it. I wondered why she was telling me this. I had decided by now that the life I was anxious to have return was here, in her. I was living again, and it had come so quickly, so stealthily, that it could only be a result of her presence. Whatever indefinable quality she had possessed as a world-renowned mannequin, she still retained, even as a slightly haggard, still lovely, blind-eyed woman of indeterminate age. In her white hospital gown, she was shapeless, but the magnetic wonder of her was there, and I was alive. I was in love. She was still speaking. After her experiences with the jet ski set and the artist's colony on Fire Island, she returned to the city and sought more and different experiences. Eventually, she came upon them, the men of the eye. They were a religious sect unto themselves. They worshipped sight and experience. This was what she had been born for. She fell into their ways at once, worshipping in the dawn hours at their many-eyed idol, and living life to its hilt. Their ways were dark ways, and the things they did were not always clean things, yet she persisted with them. Then one night, during what they called the time of the eye, they demanded a sacrifice, and she was the one so chosen. They took her eyes. I sat very still. I wasn't quite sure I'd heard what I'd heard. A weird religious sect, almost devil worship of a sort, there in the heart of New York City. And they had cut out the eyes of the most famous fashion model of all time in a ceremony? It was too fantastic for belief. Surprising myself, I found old emotions flooding back into me. I could feel disbelief, horror, sorrow. This girl who called herself Peretta and was that Peretta had brought me to life again only to fill me with a story so ludicrous I could do nothing but pass it on as dream fantasy and the result of a persecution complex. After all, didn't she have those shallow blue eyes? They were unseeing, but they were there. How could they have been stolen? I was confused and dismayed. I turned to her suddenly and my arms went about her. I don't know what it was that possessed me. I had always been shy when women were involved, even before the war, but now my heart leaped into my throat and I kissed her full on the mouth. Her lips opened like two petals before me, and there was ardor returned. My hand found her breast. We sat that way in passion for several minutes, and finally, when we were satisfied that the moment had lived its existence fully, we separated. And I began to prattle about getting well and marrying and moving to the country where I could care for her. Then I ran my hands across her face, feeling the beauty of her, letting my fingertips soak up the wonder of her. My smallest finger's tip happened to encounter her eye. It was not moist. I paused, and a gleam of smile broke at the edge of her wondrous mouth. "True," she said, and popped her eyes into the palm of her hand. My fist went to my mouth, and the sound of a small animal being crushed underfoot came from me. Then I noticed she had the sharpened stick in her hand, point upward as though it was a driving spike. "What is that?" I asked. Suddenly chilled for no reason.
"You didn't ask if Peretta accepted the religion," she answered softly, as though I was a child who did not understand.
"What do you mean?" I stammered.
"This is the time of the eye, don't you know?"
And she came at me with the stick.
I fell back, but she wound herself around me, and we fell to the ground together, and her blindness did not matter at all. "But don't!" I shrieked as the stick came up. "I love you! I want to make you mine to marry you!"
"How foolish," she chided me gently. "I can't marry you. You're sick in the mind."
Then there was the stick. And for so long now, the time of the eye has been blindly with me.